This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Daniel Pink about his latest book, which is called To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. How are you, Dan?
I'm good, David. Thanks for having me on the broadcast.
Oh, no, it's a real pleasure. I've actually read this book. I mean, you and I had tried to have this conversation a couple of times, and what happened was that I ended up reading the book twice, which has been really interesting because you learn differently when you read something for the second time. And, you know, I find this book is really, for me, very apropos. It's your thinking in this book is very much aligned with my own kind of general outlook, and so I was very... happy to find this book, and I think I learned quite a bit. I mean, the basic pitch of the book, for people who may not have read it or seen it talked about yet, is that in the modern world, unlike, you know, not that long ago when sales people were kind of looked down on as kind of gritty, difficult people you didn't want to necessarily be around all the time, today, if you look at the way people's work operates, we're all in sales, or at least a large number of people is in sales, and we think you define it as persuading. You know, that we're always, if you look at your work on a daily basis, and you're this is, I think you're really, when you say this, you're talking about people who are not manual laborers necessarily and not doing manufacturing work, but people, the vast majority of workers who are involved in some sort of, you know, you don't want to call it white collar so much.
A lot of folks in, I think the distinction between blue collar and white collar is fading a tad. And actually, I think if you look at certain kinds of employees in nominally blue collar professions or even more lower paid service professions, they're spending a lot of their time in some form of sales as well.
Well, and I think that's true, especially if you look at and so many people in this world, you know, we're moving into this kind of freelancer economy. And for those people, including myself, and that includes people who are, you know, building contractors and, you know, if you're a plumber, I mean, almost anybody who has customers is in, you're, no matter what you do, you're in the sales business, probably some large percentage of your time. You know, whatever your product or service is, you've got to have somebody to sell it to.
Absolutely right.
So I guess my first question really is, what got you interested in writing about this subject? What was the hook for you that, you know, that got you thinking about this?
Well, there's a few things. One of them was, you know, I looked at my own calendar, you know, wondering, you know, like all of us at the end of the day, wondering where a day goes and what I actually do. And since I'm a little bit obsessive and have some quantitative skills, I actually went back and looked at how I spent my time for a couple of weeks and realized that when you unpack what it is I was actually doing all day, a big portion of it was selling in some fashion, not necessarily selling books all the time, not, you know, flogging my written work, but, you know, trying to convince an editor to abandon a stupid magazine idea or trying to convince someone at an airport to help me, you know, help me out a little bit. And so I realized that, you know, if I was doing this, probably a lot of other people were like this. The other thing that got me interested in sales was a previous book that I wrote, a book called Drive, and that book's about the science of motivation. And one of the insights in that book, if you look at the work of 50 years of behavioral science, is that certain kinds of motivators, I call them if-then motivators, if you do this, then you get that, are effective for simple short-term tasks, but aren't that effective for long-term conceptual tasks. And in response to that, people started asking me, I mean, literally via email, because I had my email address on the jacket of the book, people said, okay, what about sales? You know, we pay salespeople commissions. Is that a bad idea? And then I started hearing from companies saying, well, this is pretty interesting. We eliminated commission for salespeople, and we saw sales go up. Your book helped me try to kind of sort of understand why. And because of that, I realized that in almost 20 years of writing about business, I had never really written anything substantial about sales. And so I started looking into it and realized I thought it was a very rich topic. I thought it wasn't handled very well by a lot of the popular books. There's a kind of a void in the academic study of sales. Not a void, but it's not particularly fertile ground in academic studies because most business schools don't teach sales. Therefore, you don't have a lot of scholars who are studying it. And so all those things came together, and I said, hey, let's try to write a book about sales that for people who, like, probably like many of your listeners, who might never read a book about sales.
Well, and I think what you've kind of identified in the process, I mean, there are two parts to your book in a way. The first part is the descriptive, and the second part is really more proscriptive, kind of describing how it is that we fit into the mode that you're describing, which is, let's call it the persuasion business more than, in fact, the sales business that we're...
Or, I mean, I call it the moving business. I mean, you're basically moving other people. I mean, it's persuasion is part of it, but to me, persuasion is something a little bit different. I can persuade you that, maybe I can persuade you that, yellow is a prettier color than orange, and I might have changed your mind. But what I'm talking about is getting people, and this is at the heart of sales, is getting people to give something up. By changing your mind, you're not giving up all that much. But if I say to you, hey, do you want to buy a watch? And you give me money and I give you a watch, we've both given something up and we're better off in the exchange. And I think that's what's happening when you say to someone, hey, you're working on a team or you're running a project, and you say to someone, come and work on my team rather than this other team. Now, they have to give something up. So, I mean, I don't mean to pick nits, but it's more than simply getting people to change their mind. It's getting them to move. And so that's why I actually like the phrase, I actually like the idea of the moving business.
No, I think
that's also kind of funny.
Right, you're right, you're right. I think that's more accurate. And in fact, it applies to managers who, in today's world, have to really move, get the people that work for them to align themselves with common goals. In many ways, that is also a moving experience rather than an ordering about experience. I think that, and this is what I think that there's something that's really changed over the last, I'm going to say, 20, 30 years, and that is, I think that not only do we have this kind of notion that the world is about customers now instead of about products, that the power is in the hands, as you say, the power is in the hands of the buyer, not the seller, partially because of the way the internet works, but I also think that there's been a cultural change. It's not just having more information that flattens out the experience, it's also a different concept of how to operate, which I think has to do somewhat with a cultural change born in the 60s. And I grew up in the, in the 50s and 60s, and my experience then was, in as part of the counterculture, that sales was really not a positive thing. Selling was an evil, almost. That
absolutely.
You were just doing something wrong, and that in order to kind of reconcile the fact that you have to do this all the time. It's part of human life. We live in an exchange world. Our society is built on exchange. So I think that there developed this notion that a way of understanding that exchange that was different than the traditional kind of push version, and now we have much more of a pull version. I think it comes from ultimately from the counterculture, a different set of values that it's almost like a karmic idea of exchange, and in a way that's what you're describing. That
I mean, I love the idea of a karmic notion of exchange. I mean, I think there's the explanation, and I think there's a lot to that. I think that a lot of what's going on in business today, both the entire notion of disruption, the language that we sometimes have of revolution, the idea that work is personal, a source of meaning meant to be something that has a transcendent side to it, I think very much has its roots in the counterculture. I think when it comes to sales, I think your diagnosis is exactly, your description of it is exactly right, that sales has a very negative connotation. to my mind, the explanation for that is largely something a bit simpler, and it really has to do with information. You know, most of what we know about sales, until very, very recently, comes from a world of information asymmetry. That is, the seller always knew more than the buyer. So if I'm selling you a Winnebago, if I'm selling you a vacation home, if I'm selling you corn at a farmer's market, I know a lot more about my product than you ever can. Okay, I have a huge information advantage. And so most of what we know about sales comes from that world where buyers know a heck of a lot more than, I'm sorry, where sellers know a heck of a lot more than buyers, where buyers don't have many choices and buyers don't have a way to talk back. That set of conditions is why we have the very notion of buyer beware. Buyers have to beware because sellers have such a huge advantage. But I think the big change, David, that's taken place in the last 10 years is that information asymmetry has begun moving towards something a little closer, at least, to information parity. So now buyers can have, as you know, in some cases as much, in a few cases more information than sellers can have. And so we've gone from this world where buyers have had not, you know, were at a huge information disadvantage, didn't have many choices and had no way to talk back, to today's world where they have as much information as sellers in many cases, all kinds of choices and all kinds of ways to talk back. And I think what that's done is shifted us from a world of buyer beware, which I think still holds, to a world that's also of seller beware. And I think what that's done is it's forced, whether they're doing it reluctantly or avidly, it's moved sellers to a world where they have to take the higher road, where actually that low, sleazy, slimy approach just doesn't work anymore. And so I think that move from buyer beware to seller beware is a pretty significant change. It's a change, not in degree, but it's a change in kind. And at least that's sort of the animating argument of the book. And as you say, you know, in the way that I've organized the book, you know, the first part of it is basically, let me give you some insights and new ways to look at your work. And then, you know, here's the world has changed. But then, you know, the final two-thirds is basically, okay, if I'm right or I'm more right than wrong, what do you do about it?
Right, right. And that's, I think, the perfect lead-in to talking about that, what you suggest in the next part of the book. Because I think you win the argument. I think you're pretty clear. I think you know that most of us reading your book are going to say, you're right. You know, I recognize this on a daily basis. I mean, there are always maybe an exception here and there, but basically,
yeah, sure.
in our world, this is how it is now, and I need to have better. Almost every one of us can be better. I mean, you know, the number of books that exist that have been written about how to be a better salesperson in the history of the world.
Right.
You know, many of them. And so maybe yours is among the new way of helping people understand what it is they need to do in order to, I guess, you know, it's not only just to be better at what you do, but it's also to understand what you do better. And enjoy it. I think there's part of that is, you know, if you say to people, all of us are in sales, we're really in the moving business all the time, some people might say, oh man, I'm not sure I really like that idea because I don't know how to do it. You know, it's not, you know, some people are naturally good at this and other people are maybe a little shy and unsure of their own abilities. So that's when you, I think, you know, that's where the second part of the book kind of comes in. Whether if you're comfortable with this, then this is a way of enhancing your abilities. But if this is all new and you don't really know what to do, then here's a set of kind of rubrics for that you can use to help understand how to operate in this world.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think that that not some people look at it and say, oh God, I can't believe this. This is not good news. This is kind of icky and I don't know how to do it. I think it's actually the majority of people today. You know, I think it's partly because we haven't reckoned with the fact that sales has changed so much over the years. And also the fact that we don't really have, there aren't really mechanisms to help, there aren't really mechanisms to help people do it both more effectively and more ethically.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think you know, there are some, I'm sure some companies have training programs to help, but I think a lot of the time, you know, when you go to a corporate training session, it's I think a lot of people feel they have mixed feelings about that too, and there is, you know, the sense that you're doing it because you want to be better at what you do from the outside rather than from the inside. And I think what your approach is much more, you're trying to get us to look at ourselves and see why this, you know, why the recognition of our being in sales is not a bad thing.
Right.
You know,
and exactly.
I find it refreshing and I enjoy it, but I understand not everybody does. So you came up with a replacement for the famous ABCs of selling, which is always be closing. It's still something I love that ABC, but it doesn't really apply as much today. So you've replaced those with your own ABC. I like the three that you did. I think attunement, the first one, is really important. And that is this idea of being understanding who is on the other side of the table, or the other side of the phone, or the other side of the computer. It's you, and that's something that's probably good. This is good advice for people in everyday life, whether they're selling or not. You know, just having a conversation at a cocktail party, you want to understand who the other person is rather than spend your whole time telling them how wonderful you are.
We hope that most people have that instinct. Not everybody does.
No, I think a lot of people don't. They're the ones that we run away from at the cocktail
party.
Right,
exactly.
And then you go on to buoyancy, which I think probably is one that's a little harder for people to practice, because you know, it's hard sometimes, as you say. You know, I always think about baseball players, because I love baseball and used to coach Little League, and tell these little kids who are always miserable every time they made an out, that you have to remember that in baseball, if you succeed 3 times out of 10, you're a star. And,
yeah,
you know, so that means these Major League Baseball players have done what you've said here, and that is they have learned to move on from all of the repeated rejections and understand what their business is, you know, and pay attention to this and celebrate their successes.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point that you're making here, and it actually goes to something else you said earlier, which is this resistance that people have toward the very notion of selling. Part of it is, I think they have a caricature of it as sleazy and slimy, but part of it also is that it's really hard, that you get rejected, and nobody likes rejection. And so, in fact, one of the salespeople who I interviewed in the book is this guy who's been selling Fuller brushes in San Francisco for 40 years. He says, you know, the hardest part about being in sales, he said, is that every day, this is his words, his lovely phrase, he says, every day I face an ocean of rejection, okay? And so buoyancy is, all right, how do you stay afloat in that ocean of rejection? And the good news is that the social science teaches us some clues about how to stay afloat in that ocean of rejection. And I think that those are skills that people can equip themselves with that are actually valuable even outside the realm of sales.
Oh, I was just going to say, if you think about the life of an entrepreneur, and of course today, yeah, there, you know, entrepreneurialism has become the watchword of everyday life. But there are a lot of people who leave corporate life and go into starting their own business, and the minute they run into a rough spot, you know, the really tough thing, and you know, they're no longer part of a large team, they don't have any backup, it's them, you know, you have a bad day and you want to quit.
Yeah,
you know, or
not allowed.
No, and or let's say I have been there, somebody does something really bad to you, and you know, like your biggest client says goodbye, you know, we're leaving and taking 60% of your business with us, and the first thing is, oh my god, what am I gonna do? But if you practice these the traits that are involved in buoyancy that will apply, just as you're saying, to, I mean, it's not just selling, it's to everyday life. It's probably one of the most important ways of kind of existing in the world. Now, you know, of course, I know there are people who can't. I mean, there, you know, there are people we know who are depressed or, you know, who have other issues that get in the way of their being able to do this. It's not, you know, like instantly you're going to turn yourself into this buoyant positivist person if, you know, not everybody can do it. But I think the idea is right that it's really important, and it's a way of getting through life in general, because life ain't easy. So now the third one I think is actually more complicated, and maybe I think it's one that you should talk about a little bit, and that's the idea of clarity, because I think that's the one that probably most of us have the most difficulty doing. You know, being attuning ourselves to the other one, other guy, maybe pretty, I get that. Buoyancy, I get that. But I think clarity is much harder, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So clarity has two dimensions to it. One, as we were talking about before, it's a response to changes in information. So it used to be that simply having access to information conferred some kind of competitive advantage. But now everybody has access to information. So that doesn't really matter so much anymore. So what matters more in a world that's now awash in information is a different kind of ability, which is, can you distill information, curate information, make sense of information, separate out the signal from the noise in information? So that's what clarity is. Is basically, it's a sense-making function. Can you make sense of this welter of information out there and make it understandable to people? That's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is of clarity is this. In sales, we tend to, there's been a move toward thinking about sales as a form of problem solving. And I think that's accurate in some cases. But the truth of the matter is today that when, if your customer or your prospect knows precisely what its problem is, they can find the solution without you. They don't need you that much. And so, that what's more important than problem solving in many cases is the skill of what social psychologists call problem finding. Can you identify hidden problems? Can you surface problems that people don't realize that they have? And so clarity is moving from accessing information to curating information, and from solving existing problems to identifying problems people don't realize that they have.
I think that's good. I think that actually, as you said, I think that applies to sales as well. You know, when you think about in this world, you have to be essentially, clarity kind of means being smarter. You're not just saying, here's my product, this is what it will do for you, take it, and I will, you know, here's a good deal, I'll sell this wonderful thing to you, and it's a good exchange. But I think that today, what you're saying is, even in traditional sales, that probably won't work. You know, that you have to be a kind of level higher in your understanding of what to do and how to operate. But,
right.
And I think that's really, I think that's important. And I guess, it, you know, then that also leads naturally into, you know, one of my favorite parts of the book is about the pitch. I think that I love the idea, and you kind of use the, you know, the history of the elevator to explain where elevator pitch comes from, which I thought was cool. But I like the, you know, your new pitches, and I think they're really good exercises, you know, for anybody, you know, because a lot of what we do now, it requires us to, especially, I think now in the world, you know, in the communication world of email and Twitter and kind of instant messaging, we have to be much shorter. We have to be much more, people have information overload, so you've got to be more creative. And you can't just send somebody an email. Like it used to be, even with cold calling, you could call somebody up and you probably could get through You know, you make 100 calls, you probably talk to one person. But I think today, you know, information theory probably means that we're not getting through to anybody with the stuff that we think people are listening to. You know, let's say I decide today that I want to talk to somebody I already know about a new thing I'm doing that they might be interested in. My guess is 99 times out of 100, they got so many emails that day, they didn't even notice the email I sent them.
Right, exactly.
So we've got to find other ways, and pitch is the right word or the right term, but I think what you're talking about is here, how can you be really better at this? I love the rhyming pitch, because that's really a lot of work, and if somebody's going to notice that you did, you know, something so unusual. And I loved the description of the Pixar pitch, which I think has become a bit of a meme now. Am I right about that? I don't know whether you started that, but I've heard this around in other
contexts. I it really has. It's one of those. It's very heartening. It's one of those ideas that has. It seems to have really taken off. I've been seeing it a lot of places, which is great. One of the things that keeps me in the writing business for an extra week.
Right. So, well, maybe we should talk about the Pixar pitch, just because people, you know, who are listening may want to know. Or you can go look this up. If you search on Pixar pitch, I think you will find out. You'll get back to you pretty quickly. But is it really six sentences that make the pitch, right?
Yeah, it really is, actually. So here's the idea here. It comes from some story editors at Pixar. Every Pixar movie, it turns out, has the same basic narrative structure, and that narrative structure can be reduced to six sentences that go like this: once upon a time, ba da ba da ba. You know what? Let me make sure I get it right here.
Yeah, I know.
Once upon a time. Okay, so it starts with that. That's the first sentence, obviously. Once upon a time, every day, ba da ba da ba da ba da ba. One day, ba da ba da ba. Because of that, da da da. Because of that, da da da. Until finally. Da, da, da. And so you can really take every Pixar movie and reduce it to that. It's a very powerful structure. And it also turns out to be a pretty powerful structure for pitching your idea, your business, yourself in some ways. What it reveals is, I think the reason that people like it is because it's a very simple template that people can use and then can refashion that template based on their own preferences and whatnot. And the other thing about it is what I think it reveals is that, you know, human beings are, you know, story and narrative is the way that human beings communicate in many ways. And we sometimes sometimes push that underground in business. And, you know, we see the world not only as a series of logical propositions, but also as a series of episodes. And so by capping that narrative sensibility that people have literally in their brains, I think it can be a very effective way of getting one's ideas across.
Right. I think we are narrative beings. I think about that all the time. I'm in the publishing business, and narrative narration or the narrative is so important that, it applies to almost everything we do. So in a lot of ways, the Pixar story is great because it makes it so easy to understand what a story needs to be. And because we make it overcomplicated, you know, the impulse is to tell a long story, get around to to kind of do the lead up and, you know, personalize it and get all the details out. And I think what this teaches you is, again, like the other pitches that you have here, is much more focused and a lot more carefulness in your in the way that you relate to people, the essential. I guess I would call, it's the essential of what you're trying to get across. The what's the move? Well, that's the pitch. And what you're very clear about is it's got to be pithy. Otherwise, you know, no one's going to pay attention.
Right, exactly.
So I think that's really good. Well, you know, I guess the summary of this book, and I think you said this at the end, is that sales is part of human nature in the way that you're talking about it. I think that's right. So having done this book now and having, you know, it's out there and you've talked to people, what is there one thing that you've, what's the thing that you've gotten back the most, you know, from the response from people who've been reading the book? How does it, what's the effect that you've been noticing in terms of your readers?
I think if there's a single effect, it's a little bit of reassurance that this is something that selling, whether, again, you're selling your boss on something, whether you're selling yourself, whether you're selling an idea, doesn't have to be an act of duplicity, deceit, and sleazebaggery, that it can be something that is fundamentally decent, ethical, and human, and that it's something that all of us can manage to do reasonably well. And so I think that, you know, there's a reassurance in the fact that it humanizes what sales is, takes it out of the realm of the scuzzy into the realm of the humanistic. And then also, I mean, this is a more specific thing, but most people tend to, I get a lot of comments from readers saying, hey, I'm glad that this is a book about ideas, but that also has all kinds of tools and tips and things that I can actually put these things into practice.
I think that's good. What do you think that the natural, has anybody said, you know, I could actually do this in my relationships, you know, my marriage, my...
Oh, interesting, yeah. Know,
I mean, because in a lot of ways...
Yeah, I mean, I think I find a little bit less of that and a little bit more from parents saying, hey, I can apply some of these principles with my kids.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, no, that's... I think it's... I think, obviously... The impulse would be you could apply this to anything that you're that involves relating to another human being, and
true.
That's a good thing. So do you have another book in mind for the next one, or is it something you don't want to talk about?
It's something that I would talk about if the answer to the first question was yes. I mean, I have a lot of things in mind. I haven't quite worked it out yet. I'm really focused these days on just getting through the day.
Well, I think there's no, I wasn't meaning to imply that you needed to have another project ready. Just wondering, but so you know, no pressure implied.
I'll get to that eventually. Yeah, I'll get to that eventually.
Right. Well, listen, I really appreciate talking to you about this book. I enjoyed it a lot. I've, you know, as I said, I've read it twice now, and I think it really applies.
Right.
I appreciate your talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Daniel Pink about To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having me on the program.